is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
You're going to earn your time. And so we would say, okay, our top players are playing, you know, whatever, 28 minutes. And then the next tier is 26, and the next tier is 22, and the next tier is 18, and the next tier is 6. So we would have like it mapped out. And then in practice, they're competing, and we're trying to like put people into these spots. So they know going into the game how much time about they're going to get.
Pat Woods is the girls' basketball head coach at Cape Henlopen High School in Delaware. In his four seasons, the Vikings have won four division titles, three conference titles, and been two-time state quarterfinalists, along with making it to the state Final Four in the year 2020. Pat is a two-time Conference Coach of the Year, has coached four Conference Players of the Year, and has had five scholarship players. Pat was previously the boys' JV coach at Cape Henlopen for five seasons. Woods is the founder and CEO of Factory Sports, which started in 2011. He directed 3 years of summer camps, then opened the facility in 2014. After being shut down in 2020, Woods created and published the Players' Journal for players to work on their game on their own. Woods played his high school basketball at Cape Henlopen and then moved on to Wesley College, where he scored over 1,000 points and finished in the top 10 all-time in assists and three-pointers made. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
This is Eric Gabriel, men's assistant basketball coach at High Point University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be ready with pen and paper as you listen to this episode with Pat Woods, head girls basketball coach at Cape Henlopen High School in Delaware, and the founder of Factory Sports. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Pat Woods, the head girls varsity basketball coach at Cape Henlopen High School in the state of Delaware, and also the owner of Factory Sports, which we're going to get into and talk about as we go through the pod. Pat, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the interesting things that you've been able to do throughout your coaching career and also on the business side of U Sports. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
I'm the youngest of four. And so my two older brothers were basketball players, and they kind of taught me how to play. So it started for me at a very young age. I'm saying like 3 or 4 or 5 years old on a stone driveway in Pennsylvania. That's pretty much all we could do in our neck of the woods was play basketball. So I would say, Mom, can I go out and play? And that's what we did. We just went out and played basketball or football on the street or whatever. But that was my introduction, was going to their games. I was a little kid that would run around, you know, at halftime, slide on the floor and climb in the bleachers, and kind of was raised by the whole basketball community there.
When you think about trying to keep up with your brothers, was that something that you feel like helped you as you got older, that the fact that you were always kind of chasing them and they were always a little bit older, a little bit bigger than you were?
Yeah, for sure. That was probably the best teaching I had was, you know, my oldest brother was significantly older, And so I spent some time with him. I remember him teaching me how to shoot a left-handed layup. Like there was a string tied from my elbow to my knee. I remember that teaching point. I still use it. And then, you know, he went away to school. So I have my other brother who's 3 years older than me. So we got to compete all up into high school. And that ended those competitive one-on-ones in the driveway. Usually ended with me crying and running in the house and him talking trash and sometimes throwing the ball at each other. You know, it just got, if you've experienced it, you know what
Absolutely.
I'm talking about.
For
you know,
sure.
It was just, but it taught me how to compete. And, you know, he would always say, there, just go quit again. And so it taught me how to, like, you know, when things are going bad, just keep competing, keep competing. And once I got to where I could have some level of success, or at least just stay out there and catch a couple L's right in a row, without just getting so frustrated that I can't, you know, stand it. That was just a good learning experience. I think he taught me how to talk trash a little bit. He taught me how to withstand trash talking, and just to compete.
As you got older and you get into high school, what do you remember about your experiences as a high school basketball player?
So this same brother, we moved to Delaware from Pennsylvania, and suddenly, you know, when I used to be the annoying brother, always hanging around playing with him and his friends. Now suddenly I was like, you know, we were best friends because we were the only friends right. that we had when we first yeah. moved here. One of the things I remember when I would go to their open gyms, now when we moved, we chose Cape Henlopen because they were one of the top teams in the area. And, they actually, I think the year that he got here, they lost in the state final or something like that. So they were loaded, and I would go to the open gym, and the rule was you had to lift before you could play. If you didn't lift, you couldn't play. So here I am, a young middle school kid, couldn't lift anything. The coach was just like, just try to get that bar up and then you can play. But I remember when, you know, as I, you know, kept on following him around, he would always pick me. So he was like, he'd be the senior now and he's picking me. And I knew that there was tons of guys better than me, but that meant something to me. So he always had my back. But, you know, just going through the high school, it was nice to have someone on the team. It was nice to kind of be included as I came through. I was familiar with the players. I was familiar with the coach. And you know, even as he graduated, he would come back and watch my games. And so I always had at least one fan in the stands. So yeah, my high school experience was great. I played JV as a freshman, and then sophomore year was that devastating swing year where you play JV and varsity, which usually means you sit both, right. you know, in a night. Yeah. And then,
that's rough.
Yeah. I try not to do that to my players, and yet it happens sometimes. And then junior and senior year was great, and got an opportunity to play in college after that.
As you started to take the game more seriously in high school, and you're obviously not spending quite as much time beating up on your brother in the driveway or him beating up on you,
yeah.
how'd you go about getting better? What was your process for trying to improve as a player?
I was a junkie. I still am. I can't help myself. Like, I just want to play and I want to get better. I'm still that way now, but I remember watching Michael Jordan come fly with me.
Yeah.
I remember watching, you know, they called it the kiss the rim dunk, and his footwork where he would plant his right foot and pivot and then jump. I'm like, how is he? I would pause it. I'd run outside and I try to mimic it, and I come back in and I watch it and I pause it and I run outside and try, you know, the shot on Craig Elo, I hit like 100 times in the driveway. You know, it was one of those things where,
come on, you know, we're from Cleveland, Pat.
So it was literally like watching those game films. And then I remember when I was in high school, I went to a camp in Jersey, and it was right when the first And1 mixtape came out. So literally every single kid in the camp, we were watching the And1 mixtape every single night. And then, you know, the game became chaos the next day. It was like guys throwing the ball off people's heads and traveling all over the place. But it was like, that's what it was for me. It was just loving the game and watching it and then just playing. I remember missing dinner multiple nights just because I would just be on the court and just, you know, after school, you go to the court and you play until the lights turn off and try to get a ride home and just try to figure it out. I used to, I made a deal with our middle school janitor that I would mop the floor if he let me stay and play. So there was just times like that. I don't see that a lot. It's sometimes it makes it hard for me to understand when I don't see it.
Right.
But I'm learning now that it was probably just uncommon. You know, my friends weren't with me when I was doing that. You know, I was doing it by myself then. And then one of the big development points was, as you said, as I started getting more serious, like from my junior year to my senior year, I developed a lot because I knew I was the only returning varsity player on our team. I was a starter my junior year, and then the other four starters my senior year were all JV players the year before. So I knew I was going to have to carry, you know, a large load of the work.
Right.
And so I would train with a guy who was in the process of trying out for some NBA teams and played overseas. And so we would just go at it. And he was the first one in our area to really just beat the snot out of me. Like, he would beat me 11-0 multiple times. And I was like, he was just so fast, just lightning quick. I never saw anything like it. I never played against anything like it since him. So, and I knew if I could get some points against him and try to hold him a little bit, I would be all right. And it just caused my growth to be kind of astronomical as far as my quickness improved so drastically. You know, he's a 6'2" point guard, and just like, you know, he would cross over and I'd still be at a 3-point line by the time he's dunking. And I was like, and I never faced that even in college. Like, he was just so much better than anybody I've ever played against. But it, you know, it just got me ready.
It's interesting. I think hearing you say that, looking back, you realize that you were kind of unusual in the way that you approached it, and the fact that you were a junkie and that you were going and making deals with janitors and working out with guys who were trying out for the NBA. And those are things that most kids, even kids who are playing on the varsity basketball team, probably aren't doing. And I can certainly relate to that description. I think a lot of people probably would have said similar things about me when I was a player, that, hey, there's Mike on his driveway, or there's 13-year-old Mike riding up on the park to the park to play with high school kids and college kids and adults and whatever. And I think it's just something that, whenever you have that sort of innate drive to want to get better and just that love of the game. And I think one of the things that was always hardest for me when I first became a coach, I'm curious to get your perspective on it, is when you see kids that approach it in a slightly different way, because obviously there aren't quite as many maniacal kids like you or I might have been that you're getting a chance to coach. And it took me a while to sort of, I don't know if accept is the right word, but just to sort of understand that not every kid that I was going to coach was going to approach and feel the same way about the game that I did. So I'm just curious about, when you first started coaching, how did you sort of handle the idea that not everybody was going to be as driven as you were?
I was just going to ask you the same question. I don't.
Sure. I'll answer it. I'll let you answer it first, and then I'll answer it.
Okay. Yeah. I still struggle with it. I, to be honest, it's been a problem with my second son, and I just can't understand it. Now, the problem for his situation is my wife is a Division I athlete. She's the athlete of the family. So she was the same exact way. So he gets like no break.
Right.
You know, there's no one that has
there's
any
no, there's no respite, right?
There's no compassion. You know what I mean? We're just kind of like, I don't understand. Like, if you want to be who you say you want to be, then why aren't you out? You know, and right. I'm like, I used to do this and do that. And I had one of my players probably 2 years ago just look me in the eye and say, "Coach, I'm not you." And I was just like, yeah, that's very true. Now, on the flip side of this, like, and it might have been because I don't have the raw, you know, gifts that a lot of my players do. Like, they're exceeding what I did in terms of, like, you know, I got scholarship players, and I wasn't a scholarship player. I was a Division III player. So, like, they're exceeding what I did, and they can do things that I could. I told my son that. I was like, I don't even know if there was a step back when I was playing.
Right, yeah,
like,
it didn't exist.
I wasn't doing
the
stuff
for sure
that you're doing. Yep. Yeah, like, you're far. I'm talking about the grind of it, the raw love for it. So I do still struggle with that. I think the best thing now is that I'm aware of it. And I'm aware of that fact that, like, they don't do it the way I do it, but they're also really, really good. And, you know, they might consume more content than I did just because they can. Yeah, I don't know about that, but I don't know. I'll be honest. I still struggle with it. But there are some kids that are still, you know, grinders. Like, I had to cancel. I was home sick with one of my kids that was sick, and I had to cancel, you know, a lifting and open gym session the other day. And I got an immediate call saying, "Hey, can we get in the gym and shoot while you're not there?" You know, from one of my players. So they're still out there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
Where I probably would have just not asked and broke in or something. You know, they're asking and getting in the gym. So they're still there.
Yeah. So I would answer it pretty similar. I think when I first started coaching, it's a long time ago now, you're talking 30 years ago when I first started coaching, but I know that that was a really hard adjustment for me. I remember being frustrated with players that didn't want to work as hard as I did. And I should have realized it, because even when I played in high school or when I played in college, the level of dedication of different players that I played with was different from mine. And I probably should have recognized that, but I really didn't, because I was kind of, at that point, you're kind of focused on yourself and just, hey, I got to get better and I got to do this and I got to do that. And then obviously once you start coaching, it becomes, you're not just responsible for yourself anymore. You're responsible for your entire team and for each individual player and all those kinds of things. And so it was definitely frustrating for me. And as I got further along in my career, I just came to understand the fact that there just wasn't really anything that we could do. That it was, you could try to make the things that you were doing fun. You could try to encourage. You could try to give reasons. You could try to explain, just like you did with your son, of look, if this is where you want to go, then that doesn't happen by accident. There are things that you have to do in order for that to happen. And if the kids didn't take it the way that they should have, or the way that you wanted it to, you kind of have to just, you have to move on, and you have to figure out, you got to meet them where they're at. You got to try to make them as good as they can be within the confines of who they are. You got to keep providing opportunities. So from a coaching standpoint, it was always a challenge, and it was always something that, just like you said, like, I don't understand the mentality of, if you're going to be doing this, why wouldn't you want to do it and try to maximize what you can be within the game? And so that was frustrating. And then I'll take it one step further with my own family. So I have three kids. My daughter just went to college. She stopped playing basketball in ninth grade. My son is going to be a high school junior this year, and he's still playing. And then I have a seventh grade daughter. And so I would say, for a long time, the theme on the podcast was that none of my kids were really wired like me. And my son was a kid. So my daughter stopped playing in ninth grade, like I said, and she played rec basketball for a while. And then she played a season of travel, and then she played in middle school, and she got to the high school and was in ninth grade. She was a reserve on the JV team, probably played like 6 minutes a game. And she came home at the end of that season and was like, "Dad, I don't want to play anymore. I'm not enjoying it. I don't like particularly the kids that I'm playing with, and I don't want to do it anymore." So we said, "Fine, you got to find something else to do." And she ended up going and playing tennis for a couple of years. Then my son was the kid who always loved playing, and he would go to practice, hard worker, super coachable, but just didn't want to put in necessarily the extra time. "Hey, I'm going to the gym. You want to go?" "Nah, I'm good." Mm-hmm. And about probably now it's probably been 2.5 years where that just completely flipped. And now he's in the gym all the time, wants to get better, cares about it, has gotten tremendously better from where he was. But for a long time, like, I would just look and be like, I don't understand. Like, I cannot understand what you're doing, why you don't want to do it. And yet I made a conscious choice. And I loved what you said about, like, now you're aware of it. And so I tried to be aware of it right from the beginning, in terms of how much do I push, how much do I not push. And I guess this is more of my own parenting advice, but I think they have to come to it on their own. Because my experience with people that I know, that if you push a kid to do something that they don't want to do, it's very, very rare that all of a sudden that kid starts to love it because mom or dad forced them to go to training or forced them to work out or forced them to do this. It just doesn't happen. And I think they come to it on their own. You just got to keep providing them opportunities. I think from a coaching standpoint, it's sort of that way too. Like, look, if you're going to open up the gym 3 or 4 nights a week, or you're going to be available for individual workouts, or you're going to do a bunch of stuff as a high school coach, the more stuff you have available to them, the more likely it is that they're going to show up and start to develop that love. And I think as a parent, it's the same thing. You just have to keep providing opportunities and asking and saying, "Hey, we're going to do this." And then eventually either they do it or they don't. And as you know, if you don't work at it, you're never going to be good enough anyway to accomplish what you want to accomplish if you don't work at it, unless you're some, naturally blessed athlete, which not many of us are.
Yeah, for sure. And even my, it's funny that you say that, because like I've been the trainer that I've had kids come in and I'm like, after the session, I'm like, listen, I need to know that it's the kid's decision and not your decision, like right. to the parent.
Absolutely.
You know, because it's not, it's going to be a waste of everybody's time if it's not their decision.
For sure.
And yet on the same as the parent, I want to push my kid because I don't want him to have regrets come basketball season.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yep. Like that's kind of where, that's kind of where I come with it. But I've also had the player, you know, I had one of my players come to me last year in like January and her jumper wasn't falling. She's like, coach, I think missing out on fall workouts is coming back to bite me. And I was like, yeah, I think so. And she's like, can we get in the gym tomorrow? And we went in on a Saturday and, you know, we were right back at it. So like she recognized it as well. So right. you're right. I, you know, everybody's going to have to get there, there, you know, on their own. So I can recognize that, you know, as a coach, and it helps me having, I got a lot of multi-sport players. So we've had a discussion in a team meeting where I was like, how many of you want to play college basketball? And this was last, at the time we had probably three or four,
okay.
maybe five raise their hand. And I'm like, so I explained to the multi-sport athletes, like these girls, this is their main sport. And this is like what they're working on at all times, like in the summertime, in the fall, in the spring, and now in, during the season, they're working on this stuff. And so we need all of you guys to give a maximum effort for them. You mean they, this is very, very serious to them. So this isn't like their third sport or their second sport. Like this is the main thing. So like you guys need to know that they're about this. And this is very, very important for them. The exposure events that we go to are very important for them. And then on the flip side, these girls are, a lot of them are trying to stay in shape. They love the game. They want to keep playing, but they're also going to go to college and play Division I lacrosse. So like it's a little bit different and you need to recognize that as well. You know what I mean? So like we just try to, I just try to, whenever we have any kind of conflict where like that, we always just try to get it out in the open and talk about it. And it seems to help, you know, so, you know, and I understand that those players aren't grinding, you know, they probably don't touch a ball until it's November.
Right.
You know, and my plea to them is like, I just need you just 1 hour a week, just right. 1 hour
yep.
a week,
just pick up a ball. Yep.
Yeah. And it usually doesn't happen, but you know, they obviously bring a lot to the table just in terms of their athleticism and killer instinct and things like that. So
for sure. Yeah. I think it's a great understanding. Point, yeah. I think it's a great point of making those conversations happen, because at least if you get it in front of everybody and everybody kind of understands where the other ones stand, it makes it easier for them to connect and then to be able to relate to sort of the mentality of what is going through everybody's head. To me, that makes a lot of sense if you can have those conversations. And I think when we talk to coaches on here, I think one of the things that comes through is the fact that you got to have that proactive communication in so many different circumstances, whether it comes to a situation like this where it's just helping teammates to understand where they're coming from, whether it's player coach talking about roles on the team, whether it's expectations. There's so many things that you can head off problems by proactively communicating with your kids. And I think if you do that, you're going to end up with a lot better environment for both yourself and ultimately for your team, which again, translates eventually to results in the wins and losses and just a better experience for everybody who's involved in it. That communication to me is critical.
Yeah, 100%. We had during my exit interviews with my team last year, that was the main thing that they brought up. We had some internal conflicts last year. And my question was, how do we prevent those? You guys obviously had a lot going on that we were unaware of, that half the team was unaware of. How do we prevent that from kind of festering next year? And almost every single player, including the seniors, were like, I think a lot of the problems are going to graduate this year. You know, they said it about themselves.
That's fine.
And then, but they were also like, but that, you know, we had a meeting before one of our games, that we, it was a total like kind of blow up. And just kids just weren't having fun, even though we were winning. We were like a 10 game winning streak. They just weren't enjoying it. And I was like, well, how do I become aware of that? And it was just the proactive piece is that this year we're going to have to make sure that we're having those sit downs with the entire team and just having those discussions on a weekly basis. So we put in a protocol. Our coaching staff is like, you know, identifying, okay, each one of us has to have one you know, brief conversation with each player per week, you know, just about non-basketball stuff, just to, you know, during stretches, just make sure that you touch on each player in the gym once a week. And then we're going to have like a weekly meeting. It won't be as long, but just to make sure that whatever needs to be said gets said quickly, because the team felt great afterwards. I felt terrible afterwards, but the players felt great after this meeting. You know, just to get some things off the chest. And, but yeah, it's the proactive, have the discussion. It's also, that's a life skill, is like when you have stuff going on, you got to talk about it,
right,
and come up with a solution. You know, we're not placing blame, but once we address it, the rule is always, okay, we addressed it. We're not bringing it back up. We're dealing with it. It's dealt with, whatever. Like we do that with a punishment. All right. We ran our sprints. It's over. No one bring it back up. It's done. And then we move on from it.
When something's hidden like that, I mean, I think that's one of the toughest things to deal with as a coach. And it's one of the things that I think when you talk about different issues or problems that arise on teams, I think so often when there's something going on that not everyone can see, whether that's not everyone on the team, whether that's not the coaching staff. And I think by being conscious of having those conversations and by making sure that it's not just you as the head coach, but also assistant coaches, and you're talking, the kids are talking amongst themselves. And the more you can get people communicating, I think number one, it builds that trust. And then once you have the trust in place, now you get a case where if there is something going on, you're much more likely to have the girls on your team be honest and say, hey, here's what is going on, here's what I see. And then that gives you a chance as the coach to be able to address that and bring it really out into the open so that everybody can talk about it. And as you said, move on to the next piece of whatever it is that you're going to do in your practice or your season, and just make sure everybody's on the same page. But that's a challenge. It's not easy to do that. Like you said, it's a huge life skill to be able to build that up, to be able to build that trust, to build that confidence, and to have those tough conversations. Cause we all know that it's a lot easier to just kind of push those things under the rug and just pretend like everything's okay, when the reality is that you need to have that conflict. If there's an issue, you want to get that out in front of it and make sure everybody's talking to one another.
Yeah, for sure. We deal with that. I know you wanted to talk about the business side of stuff, but we do that as well. Like you have to be willing to have conflict and tough conversations. One is having the conversation and trying to be clear and express yourself without, you know, obviously it's a trust issue, without fear of, I don't want to offend anybody. Right. You know, that's usually how we think. We usually think, sure, I don't, yep, say anything because I don't want to offend you.
Right.
And we think we're doing a good deed, but really we're being selfish about it, because I don't want the feelings of I've offended somebody. You know, we're trying to prevent, correct, ourselves from feeling, correct, that way. But once we do that, there's also the skill of, okay, after these things have been said and we kind of can deal with the issue, there's also like, how do we get back? Like, how do we bounce back and recover from some hard things were just said, you know, from the next practice and the next getting after it? There's got to be that level of, I trust,
right,
that you want the best for me, and I need you to know that I want the best for you. And while I might say some things that could be hurtful or just things that I recognize that might be a blind spot for you, it's not like I'm trying to harm you. I'm trying to help you and help us. So that's just, like you said, that's a hard thing to go through. And it takes a lot of time. It's not like there's no strategy, I don't think, to figure that out. But as you guys know, like, that's also like that's a family situation that you got to go through with your spouse and with your kids. And so if we can teach them these things and have some experience of like, here's how you have like a healthy conflict and discussion in a basketball team, and in a, where it's obviously, right, really important to us, but it's not really important, you know, like this will be a great life skill that they can carry with them, like for the rest of their lives. So we got to be willing to have it.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any question that if you can utilize the game of basketball in a situation like this to be able to help them to understand how to deal with that, and then when they get into it in their real life, they're going to be way, way better off. And like, when you think about your family, right, when conflict arises in your family, you can disagree and you can hash that out, and then you can move on from it because you have this shared history of trust, and you know that ultimately you have a shared common goal as a family of maintaining the happiness and helping everyone to be their best and all those things, which are the same things that you have on a team, obviously on a smaller, as you said, less critical scale, but still very important to everybody who's involved in it. And to be able to go through those processes and then to be able to talk about them and help kids to understand that this doesn't just affect us here in basketball, but there's eventually going to be situations, even if you haven't faced them yet in your life, that you're going to. And I think that's one of the great things about coaching is the fact that, you know, not only do you get to coach basketball, but you're also getting to use the game of basketball to teach those life lessons, to have an impact on the players that you get to be in front of every day. And when you think about it, let's go backwards a little bit. When you're playing and you're a high school player, you go on and talk and play in college, at what point do you start thinking about coaching, and were any of the coaches that you played for influential in your decision to become a coach?
I don't remember ever thinking about being a coach like the way I coach now. Like I don't remember ever thinking about that as a player. I always thought I'm going to play forever, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of the way it is.
I was the same way.
Now, at the same time, at a very young age, I was, you know, one of my first jobs was running basketball camps and helping out. And then I was the camp director. And then I was, you know, so I've been coaching. For the longest time, I was like, I don't have any coaching experience. And then I look back and I was like, man, I've been coaching basketball camps for like 15 years prior to, like, you know, and coaching and training, because I was trained, you know, in my junior year in high school on to, you know, in college, I would have people, if you're the local guy in town that can play and is playing in college, people just call you up and say, hey, can you work with my kid? So, you know, you started doing stuff like that. And I would always be involved in training that way. I would be the guy that was running the workouts in college in the off season when the coach wasn't around. You know, I would do that stuff. I never thought about it in terms of being a quote unquote coach. Like, I just never thought about it. Now, once I decided I wanted to coach, you know, a team, a high school team, you know, as the head coach, my first calls were to my high school coach and an assistant on the college coaching staff. So obviously they had an impact for sure. Like, I called those guys immediately, and I met with them, and I sat down and said, I want it all. Tell me everything that you do. Give me, you know, and you know how, well, most coaches just want to share everything they have.
For sure.
And so, you know, they're just like unloading more than I could probably handle at the time, but they certainly had an impact on me. I never thought about myself as going into coaching after playing. But it was pretty natural because, you know, I was a point guard. So it was kind of my role as a player. I just never thought about it in those terms.
Yeah, it's funny. I was exactly the same way. Like, it never dawned on me whatsoever that when I got done playing that I was going to coach. And part of it, I think, I love what you said of, I thought I was going to play forever. I think I'm going to play forever. And I think I felt that way too, that just my identity for so long had been as a basketball player that I just had a hard time ever thinking about, am I going to shift gears and do something else? It was just never on my radar. At school, what'd you major in?
Sport management.
Okay. So what was the idea that you wanted to do? What was your thought process in terms of career?
I mean, I had to choose a major, and I was like, I like sports. I think that's about as far as it got. You know, I looked into at an early age, like, I think it was elementary school, I had a project where I was looking in, you know, they make you like pick a career and study it and whatever. And I wrote a letter to Jack Nicklaus. I wanted to be a golf course designer. You know, that was very short lived, but like, that was the idea. Okay. I always just wanted to be involved in sports
gotcha.
Somehow. Yeah.
Cool.
And then, you know, in college, I forgot about this until my dad brought it up. Once we started our business, was one of my senior projects in one of my classes was a gym, a private gym that we built and called the Factory. I just, for somehow it just like, And then we did it like years right. later.
Yeah.
And he somehow, you know, my dad held on to everything, just like whipped out this project that I did in college. And hey, remember this? I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you still have it.
That's hilarious. How much of it was applicable?
Not much, you know, when you do a budget and I'm like, you have no clue how much stuff costs. You know what I mean? To the point yeah. when we started our business, we had no clue how much right. stuff costs. And like,
yeah, I'm sure
whatever we originally planned multiplied by a factor of six before we, you know, actually opened our doors up. So it was a process, but that was a whole nother education. I probably learned more in that whole process than I ever did in a classroom.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. What you draw up in a business class or in a sports management yeah. class or anywhere, or a coaching class for that matter, compared to what you actually do when you have to do it is a completely different story. I don't want to shortchange your college career. Tell us a little bit about your playing career in college.
It was great. I just told this story to one of my players who's now, you know, she always left practice. This is part of the conversation with like, not everybody's a basketball player. This girl had to miss lots of practices because she was like a band major. Like she led our band. So now she's in college in a band and she's talking about making all these, I don't know, like jazz band. There's like, I don't know much about it, but there's like a whole bunch of different groups that she needs to join. So she has all these auditions and tryouts. She feels like I'm not good as good as these players or whatever. And I'm just like, so I recounted the story. I was like, I remember it was our last tryout my freshman year. And the coach that recruited me was like, you might start for us as a freshman and get a lot of time. And I was stinking it up. I think I was just shocked, you know, the physicality and the speed of the game was, I had a hard time adapting to it early on. And I was just so light. I was playing behind 2000 point scorers. And the one dude, I remember he was running a shuffle cut and he would just pick me up off the ground and slam me in this pick. And I can't do anything to like stop it from happening. And then I'm getting ripped to shreds because I can't guard this guy.
Right,
I'm, like, I'm just like hanging off for dear life, trying to survive. And he calls, this is our third or last scrimmage, and calls a timeout. And he like looks me dead in the eyes. Now he's addressing, you know how this goes, addressing the whole group. Nobody's names are mentioned, but everybody knows he's talking to me. He's like sure. looking at me right in the eye. And he's just like, some of you guys, we really thought we're going to have an impact and you're on the verge of getting cut and not even being on this team. And I'm like, ah. You know, so I went through that and I don't think I played much better that game. You know, I was barely kept on. And then I was like the backup point guard. And then the very first half of the first game in a tournament in Roanoke, the starting point guard breaks his ankle and I'm in there and I'm like trying to keep it together, well, you know,
welcome to college basketball.
Yeah, that's right. And so like, and for me, the bigger thing was not gaining the acceptance of my coaches. It was, I needed the respect of my teammates. Like I knew that they didn't trust me and that was a problem. So like, I wanted to earn their respect more so than I wanted to earn the coach's respect. And in that first game, like, I don't know, I think the first shot I hit was like a kick out three at the top of the key and I just buried it. And then like, I hit like a couple more and ended up with 12 points. And like, I remember after like we won the game and I had a huge part of that. Like, I think they were all like, oh no, what's going to happen? You know, our point guard's gone.
Right.
And I stepped up and just performed. And I started from that game on ever since. And it was just kind of like, it was just one of those moments that like, you know, there's the opportunity. Things went well. And that was it. I remember praying a lot in the locker room. I remember just, you know, not knowing how it's going to go. Totally different environment and turned out to have a great career. I really enjoyed the point guard that went down and he just never came back from his injury and just he was one of those guys that had like the short leash where like right. you make one mistake and you get yanked out of the game. I never yeah. understood it. I thought we were better when we were on the court together. But you know, that's just how it went for him. And I just never came off the court. I was the point guard. And then if he would come in, I'd get moved to the two and I just was able to stay on the court just because I think it was IQ and I was just always in the right spot. I knew what was going on. I wasn't the best scorer. I wasn't the best, you know, whatever, but I was always on the court. So I ended up being, you know, in the record books and scoring and assists and three pointers just because I was always on the court.
It's so easy to, it's so much easier to play when you know you're going to be on the floor. And
yeah, for sure.
There's like, I think about myself as a player. I think about watching my own kids play. I think about the, you know, again, just the sheer number of games that I've watched. And as a college player, my experience was sort of similar to yours. I didn't play very much as a freshman, but then from my sophomore year to my senior year, I started every game. And I think I averaged like 37 minutes a game, you know, so I'm, you know, I wasn't getting pulled out for mistakes. I was able to go out there and play. And if I missed some shots, I just, you know, I was out there. And it's so much easier to play in that environment. And then you watch some teams, you watch some coaches coach, and there's players that immediately, as soon as they make a mistake, even if they're starters and they're on the bench, and even if they're out for 30 seconds and then back in, like, to me, that's always just such a tough way to play. I'm just curious, how did that, has that impacted, when you think about your experience as a player, has that impacted sort of the way you coach and handle your rotations and substitutions, or the way that you deal with players in game? I'm just curious how your experience impacts that.
Yes, absolutely. I felt the same way. We've all been there where you're playing not to make a mistake. And right. So inevitably you make a mistake, you know, you just can't, you're thinking about way too much rather than just playing and maximizing your time in there. So yeah, I was, even when I was like an assistant with the boys varsity, I was always like, we got to like, just let them go a little bit. We can't have a quick, you know, just yank them out as soon as they make a mistake. Now on the flip side, there's some games where you just like, sorry, like right. You can't get comfortable if you're not ready to go right now.
Right.
I'm pretty sure this kid can get back in. He's had a minute. He's good. Like, right. So right. there are some games like
yep.
that.
Yep.
But the way we do our subbing, number one, I don't think I'm good at handling substitution. So one of my assistant coach does all of our subbing. So we talk, because I'm just like, yeah, I'm so focused on what's going on the court
right.
that I can't worry about who's on the bench. I mean, there's times when I was doing everything as a JV coach for the boys, and I remember looking down the bench. I was like, somebody get him out. And then I'm like, I don't want any of you guys in the game.
Like, right. I know.
I'd rather go with four.
Like, trying to sub and coach the game. I think people who have not coached or have not been in that position as a head coach, and I don't care what level it is so difficult to try to keep track and manage. Like, even I'll say, even on the youth level, like when I've been coaching my own kids, and let's say I have a team of 9 or 10, and I might go into the game and prepare and think about a rotation of how I'm going to sub those players in. But as you're standing up there coaching, like to try to remember and make sure, oh, I got to get this one in and that one in, and this one's been in for 4 minutes and now I got to rotate that person out. Unless you have, if you are there by yourself, which oftentimes as a JV coach, you're there by yourself. That is unbelievably hard to do. I think people severely underestimate how difficult it is to coach the game and be able to sub, even in the way, even if you take a lot of time to plan it beforehand, it's really tough.
It didn't take me long to realize I can't do this. I need you to handle. So our statistician, I was like, I need you to handle all the subs.
Right.
And he loves that kind of stuff. So we talk throughout the day about, you know, rotations and stuff. You cool with this? You cool with this? We went to a team camp in the summer. We were doing this. Like, he's as crazy as I am as far as like, we want to make sure. So it works out really well.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
We have lots of conversations. But like, so, and we had a super competitive team the last couple of years. We just had athletes. Like, they could just go. There was games where I didn't have to pay attention and we would win by a lot in our conference. We were just really dominant. And so we had to like, the players were really concerned, like, coach, am I even going to play this year? Or are we going to get up really big and I'm going to play, you know, part of the first half and then sit the rest of the game? I said, no, you've earned the time. You're going to earn your time. And so we would say, okay, our top players are playing, you know, whatever, 28 minutes. And then the next tier is 26, and the next tier is 22, and the next tier is 18, and the next tier is 6. So we would have like it mapped out. And then in practice, you know, they're competing and we're trying to like put people into these spots. They're like, all right. So they know going into the game how much time about they're going to get.
Right.
You know, obviously it fluctuates with foul trouble and it fluctuates with, you know, how the game's going, but it was so nice, I think, for the players. Some of them didn't like it, especially when they were coming out, but like we would have our best, you know, some of our top players, the stars, like, you're starting, but at the 4 minute mark, you're coming out every single game. It doesn't matter how well you're playing or how poorly you're playing. You're coming out. You're going to get a minute break on game clock, minute break, and then you're coming back in for this player. So they knew right away. So what it did was it totally took out the arms flying up in the air. Why am I coming out? You're coming out because it's your time to come out. Yeah. So like it, that we never have that problem. We never have people wondering why they're coming out. They know exactly why they're coming out and they know when they're going back in,
right.
You know, unless something crazy happens, according, you know, that's off script, that's what's going on. So like when we're in, you know, we played some top teams in the country last year and we would have, you know, my assistant coach would be like, yep, do you want her? Do you want her coming in? And I'd be like, no. Now, there was one time where I said that too loud and the player was like, coach, that was hard to hear. Like, yo, do you want her in the game? And I was like, no.
No.
I was like, what? No, can't have her in the game. And it was the dagger. You know, she heard that conversation. But no, so we map it all out. And it was for that reason that you brought up, was that I want them to know about how many minutes they're going to get. So, you know, you always have those players like, for whatever reason, our 5 and 6 have always been kind of like equal, like on the depth chart, like,
right.
Oh, which one do you start? Which one do you not start? And so it's very much like a who needs their name announced at the beginning of the game and who can handle coming off the bench. You know, right. It's always one of those conversations. And I'd be like, you guys are going to get the same exact amount of minutes. It's just about, we're going to start her because I think it'd be better for us to start this way. And you come in and give us a spark off the bench. And they've always been cool with it. And I think that's super unselfish of them, of the players. And a lot of girls have been in those situations and it just makes for a better, you know, one of our core values is unselfishness. So, you know, you got to sacrifice a little bit and for what's best for the team and they handle that. But like I said, it takes away the, as soon as I make a mistake, I'm out of the game. No, as soon as, you know, your stint in the game is up, you're coming out of the game.
It's proactive communication again, just like we talked about earlier, right? Where you're going into it, where it's not, you're not having to explain it as the girl's coming off the floor and she's got to sit down next to an assistant and go through, hey, here's why you're coming out. Here's when you're going back in. Like everybody already knows that. So to me, that makes a ton of sense. And I love the thing that you said about your best players, especially when you have a good team and you're winning a lot of games, you're blowing teams out. And now those kids are looking going, man, I'm only playing half the game in some of these games because we're killing teams. And I know that I've experienced that as a player a long, long time ago, but more recently I've experienced it like with my son's team where he's a starter and you're playing and all of a sudden come off after the game. You're like, how was that game? Oh man, just, you know, it's terrible. Like, you know, we won, but you know, we won by 40 and you know, we played less than half the game. And at a certain point, I think you look at it, you say your best players, especially if you're in a situation where, I mean, if you're winning big a lot, and let's just say, especially as you said, like you're dominant within your conference, which means you're probably going to win a lot of conference games by big numbers. If those kids aren't going to play as much at a certain point, it's like, you got to get your best players to have to play. They deserve it. Again, there's a reason why they're the best players. And so you want them to be able to maximize their playing time. But I think that's something that people often don't necessarily think about. Like there's the fine line of, right, people, I don't know, feel sorry for is the right word, but there's always the, well, you know, we got to get player 11 or 12, you know, these minutes. But the reality is that players 1 and 2, they're better players for a reason, probably because they put more time into it, probably because at least in the off season, they care a little bit more about it. They care about being better. And so it's a fine line. It's a fine line there between like, how do we, obviously you want to be able to get everybody in the game when you're winning big, but at the same time, you don't want your best players to feel like, man, every time we play really well and blow a team out, then my minutes go down. I don't play as much. And that doesn't seem fair either. So again, I think it's communication, but it's a point that you don't often hear brought up, that winning big sometimes cuts down on your best players' playing time.
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
We play 20 games in a regular season, and 14 of them are conference games. So, like, when we would play, we were scheduling, like, Paul the Sixth out of D.C. is who we had. We played them this year. We played Westtown. Like, we played, like, really top teams in our region.
Right.
I can't have my starters playing half a game for 14 games.
Right, for sure. Absolutely.
And then be ready for playoffs and ready for – and we're kind of hindered by our schedule to where we can't schedule appropriate to our ability. So we have 14 games that are going to be blowouts. So it's really hard to keep them fresh, to keep them engaged, to keep, you know, because then the other thing is, like, they don't have to play as well as they can play in order
Correct.
To win.
Absolutely.
So, like, so one of the things we did this year is I say, all right, you guys got 5 sprints tomorrow. And they're like, why? I'm like, well, these are the 5 sprints. Unless if you out rebound the opponent by this, we'll take one off. If your assist to turnover ratio is this, we'll take one off. If you do, you know, and if their field goal percentage is this, we'll take one off. And if you score 50 points by halftime, all bets are off. And that, so then I said, my seniors, so we had games where seniors, you get the first half, the 2023 team has got the second half. So those are your marks. And so, like, there was maximum effort taking place all throughout that first half. Like, they were, like, they were talking to each other. They were huddling up. Like, they were totally locked in. And I felt like they really got a good workout in that, you know, half the game. And then we were still able to get, you know, the other girls a maximum, an entire half, you know,
right.
for their game. So, like, obviously it's a good problem. Right. And I'm not trying Correct. To make light of that because there's going to come times where we have other problems, but, like, it was legit a problem. We spent a lot of time thinking about how do we do this? And what about the sportsmanship concern, you know, with the other team? Like, and I had one of my assistants say, coach, you can only coach one team. Like, as much as we're not trying to blow people out, but we're also trying to coach our team, you know, and the way you perform well is, like, I said, this is no different than practice. We don't let them get away with laziness or get them, like,
for
you
sure.
can't just, like, miss a closeout or not box out, or, like, you can't do that. So we're going to jump you. So in the game, I'm going to jump you too. Well, what that equals is not many mistakes and the other team not scoring much, you know? So, like, if a team struggles, you know, they're really going to have a hard time with the way we were playing defense. So, like, you know, it ended up in being lopsided scores, but the focus was always, we're trying to win in March and we have to prepare for that as much as we want to get everybody equal time and all this kind of stuff. We have to prepare because these girls have spent their entire lives working towards this.
Right.
And we can't just shortchange them because the rest of the team, the schedule that we're playing is not as competitive. So we felt obligated to our team.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
And you know, you got to get ready for next year. We got to get you guys ready for college.
Right. You got to play hard. You got to execute. And I think when you do that, regardless of who's on the floor, look, there's times where can you do things within the confines of your system of how you play where you can dial it
multiple
back.
Reversals.
Right. Yep. You can dial it
only
back.
Wide open layups or three,
for sure.
Whatever. Yeah.
For sure. There are ways that you can dial back what you're doing. Again, I wouldn't be an advocate of playing a team that you're up 50 and you're still throwing your diamond press or you're running jump at them. In the
Correct.
Second quarter when you already have a 40-point lead, like, that to me is not good sportsmanship. But if you get upset because we're going to continue to play hard within the confines of what we do and we want to execute, to me that's never rang true. I know there's been times where I've coached teams, especially at the youth level, where you run into a team that's way better than you, and sometimes you get coaches that have good sportsmanship and do what I just described. And unfortunately, sometimes you have coaches who, even at the fourth, sixth grade level, they're up 30 in the first half and they're still going to press you. And I don't like it. It's not necessarily what I would do, but when people would come to me and say, well, hey, they shouldn't be doing this or that, my response is always, well, we got to get better. And you, as an individual player, and if a parent comes to me, I say, hey, your son, your daughter has to get better, and we have to get better as a team, and we don't have to like it. And I wouldn't do that to another team or another coach, but if they're going to do it, the response to me is always, I got to figure out a way to get better. It goes back to what we talked about at the beginning with sort of your mentality as a basketball junkie and someone's going to keep working at it. Like my response is probably more a response of me as a player. Like, I'm not going to let somebody do that to me. I'm going to go out and get better and work at it so that doesn't happen again.
Yep.
And I think as a coach, that's the mentality and kind of the way I've always tried to approach it. And yet I think what you have to do, no matter which side of that equation you're on, is you want your team to play hard and to execute, whether you're up 30 or you're down 30. And to me, that's really what coaching is, right? That's what the best coaches do. Is it's not, hey, we're winning this game against an inferior opponent, so I don't really care that we're making a bunch of mistakes because we're winning. And conversely, as a coach, if you lose, sometimes you can play to the best of your ability and compete as hard as you can. And sometimes you may not win on the scoreboard. And so I think good coaches understand that and really try to make sure that what you're focused on is, as you said, coaching your team and trying to make sure that they're executing the best they can, regardless of what the game situation is. And I think if you do that, which it sounds like that's kind of where your program is that now you're maximizing what your team can do, but also maximizing what each of your individual players can do by putting them in those positions.
For sure. I used to say that, you know, the fourth quarter, we would have the JV team in the fourth quarter. And I'm like, I don't expect you guys to go out here and lose. Like, the score is 0-0 right now. I'm going to coach you and you're going to play so that you can win the quarter. Like, you have to do that. And I always used to think to myself, like, people would get upset. It really didn't happen too often. But if the other team was upset, I'm like, well, you're more concerned about the score than I am.
Right.
Like, I'm not thinking about the score. I'm thinking about how we're playing. And I think you ought to do the same thing. Break it down into 4-minute increments if you want and try to win those 4 minutes and try to win the next four. You know, just keep on competing. That's the only way we can get better, which is exactly what we did. Like, we got blown out by Archbishop Carroll the same year that we were blowing others out. And it was in our state, they were up by 35 and in the second half, and it becomes a running clock.
Okay.
Now in Pennsylvania, I don't know if that was a rule. And so they brought both coaches together and explained that rule to us and asked us if we wanted to do it. And simultaneously, me and the other coach said, no, stop it. We're trying to get better.
Right.
Like, I don't want to just get the game over with because I know we're not going to win, but we can work on some stuff and do some things. Like, so this summer, we were getting a team was pressing us. And like I told you, like we weren't allowed to practice in the summertime. So we had no press break in. And right, I have a whole new, we lost our top, you know, six seniors last year. They were all five starters and a six man. So like I got all new kids and I haven't taught them much of press break or whatever. And he jumped up on us by 20 and he's like, all right, girls, we're pulling off the press. And half of them, I say, hey, can you put the press back on? He's like, really? And I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, right. I want to win a summer league game. Like, what does this matter? Exactly. But yep. What I need to do is learn how to run a press break. So I'll tell you when it's enough, but like, I'm going to try to make a change. I'm going to put some people in different spots and I want to teach them live how to break a press.
Right.
And we'll go from there. So like, and he completely understood that. And he was like, just so you know, we're not trying to, I said, I know, I'm asking you to, because we're trying to get better. I don't care what the score is. I'm just trying to like learn and get better. And this is the best way for us to do it, is to face the press and to do it. I said, who cares about the score? It doesn't matter. Let's try to get better. And I think that mentality, I wish I had that mentality all the time. You know, like we should always have that mentality with the score. Obviously, there's time and score in certain situations, but to be able to play relentlessly, no matter what the score is, no matter how much time there is on both sides, my team and their team, that's how everybody gets better.
Yeah, no question. That running clock rule came in Ohio, I think last year. And I remember sitting in the stands and there was a game that my son was playing in and we were up by whatever. I think it was 35. I forget the time mark where it turned into a running clock, but all of a sudden looking up at the clock, I'm like, the clock's running. I mean, you talk about a terrible situation for those kids who are at the end of the bench, right?
Yep.
So here's a case where those kids could have gotten a lot of minutes. And you and I both know that when the clock is running, like, especially in, it's one thing to run it in a summer league game, but it's another thing to run it in a real game. Like, that goes so unbelievably fast.
Yeah. The refs are not in a hurry to get the ball to the shooter at the free throw line. Everybody's just, like, taking their time.
Yeah.
It's
because nobody's,
and
used,
we don't have a shot clock.
Yeah. We don't have one either. Like, yeah.
You could literally just, that was the other thing. I was like, if I just hold the ball and we win this game at the, no one's learning anything.
Right.
This is not good for anybody. It's not good for the girls that are in the game. I don't want to put them in at the end of the game and they just get to hold it. Like, that's no good. And
right.
as a when I'm down, I don't want them to hold it.
Correct.
Like I'd rather you run the score up than hold the ball. It's much more frustrating when you're playing like keep away and I can't even play the game. I'm just running around in circles.
I could not agree more. Like, to me, I always feel like that there's a perception among some coaches that you're up by 25 and you get down to like the last minute 10 and you're just holding the ball and you're just playing keep away. And to me, that's the opposite of good sportsmanship. Like, if I'm on that other sideline, like, I want to keep playing, because chances are at that point, I probably have my subs in the game and those kids never get to play. And so for them just to have to run around and chase the ball doesn't do them any good. And I'm sure the other coach has their subs in the game at that point. And those kids want to play. They don't want to just hot potato the ball around for a minute and 30 seconds as to run the clock. I'm always like, just play it out. Like, what is it at that point? What does it matter? Like, the kids want to play. I guarantee you could pull all 10 of those kids and they're like, they just want to play the game regardless of what the score is. Yep. Cause again, most of the time they're just not the ones that are in the game all the time. So there's so many little, I think, subtle things that if you really look at them or you really think about them, both from a playing and a coaching perspective, sometimes that we get things kind of goofed up. The scoreboard sort of jades us in terms of what we should be doing to try to help our kids really get better and to help them enjoy it. I mean, because ultimately that's a big part of it too, is what's their experience like. And I think that if you're going to play against a team that's just going to hold the ball in the left, to me, that's goofy. I'd rather just keep playing.
Agreed.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the business side of it. Tell me how the factory, how you get that started, and what the genesis of it was. Is, I know you said you're working with your dad on it, but just how long you guys been in business and what was the original idea and how has it changed? As you said, you got a huge education and going through the process. So just tell us about the original vision and kind of where you guys are now.
Yes, this is year 9, I believe. And really it started with, I used to run the sports program for the YMCA locally. And then I had a job interview with a YMCA in Missouri. Now we're in Delaware. It's like 15, 20 hours away. And my in-laws live right next door. And so they were like, so let me get this straight. You're going to get a job in Missouri and take our daughter and our grandkids 20 hours away. Well, so
you were a pretty popular guy at that point.
So my father-in-law also owns a custom cabinetry and millwork business that he's had forever. And so they have warehouses and he's like, well, this warehouse is empty. What about doing it right here? So the idea from him was like, if you're going to run sports programs in the YMCA, just do it right here. And so I'm like in there and I'm like, I don't know that this, they had a second floor. So I'm like, now anyone who builds things like my father-in-law does can like see through walls. Like they're like, oh, just take that wall down. I'm like, what do you mean? Just take the wall down. So he's like, can it fit in here? And I'm like, I don't think the ceilings aren't high enough. It's not why I had all the reasons why it wasn't going to work. And then, we started doing some measuring. I was like, this might work. So we ended up gutting the building and taking the top floor out. And you know, my original plan was like literally paint lines on concrete slab and have portable rims in there and just try to run programs out of there. At the time, we had already run 3 summers of summer camps in the local schools, which was so difficult to try to get them to commit to us being in there. And by the time all the paperwork was signed, it was too late to like market it. So it was just really difficult to make that happen. So having our own facility would work. So we were pushing up on July. We knew we could have the summer camps in there. But like I said earlier, we started with concrete slab and lines, and you know, whatever money we planned on spending at that time ended up being 6 times that. One of the turning points was the floor. I was actually looking for bleachers and I saw a hardwood floor for sale on this website. And if you've ever seen a hardwood floor not laid out, it's just like stacks of wood. Like you can't really tell what it is.
Right.
So I'm like, I don't even know. And I'd never, you know, looked for a hardwood floor before. So like, I don't even know what I'm looking at right now, but it's hardwood. And it's, you know, we had an estimate coming in for poured rubber.
Right.
Some of our middle schools have the rubber synthetic floors.
Okay.
So it was going to be the same cost for the hardwood. And my wife's like, well, what would you rather have, rubber or hardwood? I was like, if I can have hardwood, I would definitely want hardwood. So we were just praying about it. That was kind of like, okay, well, if we get this floor, we're moving forward. Because if we get, once we do this, there's no turning back. So like we were just praying about it. And I think the Philadelphia Police Athletic League was interested in it. They'd already gotten floors from these guys. And I was like, listen, if I can write you a check tomorrow, if I can have this floor. And then I called the bank. I was like, hey, can I write a check tomorrow? Get this floor? You know, I was like, I didn't even know how any of this worked. You know, I'm just a basketball guy.
Right.
So like, they're like, yeah, but you got to find out who this is. So you don't write a check and never see the guy again. I'm like, oh, wow. Great idea. So I start investigating and like, well, who do you work with? And it turns out the floor was from the Meadowlands, from the Izod Center. It was the Nets floor.
Gotcha.
From
like when they played those. I've seen those before. A lot of times.
Like the Argyle.
Yep, for sure.
Jason Kidd and those guys. Yeah, yep. That's the floor that we got in our building. So I was like, what? Why didn't you lead with that? I definitely want this floor. Like the history of it immediately. I'm thinking Jay Kidd and Vince Carter. And you know, that's my first thought. I'm like, we're going to get the play on this. Turns out we had to sand all the logos off and not use them. But like, it was really cool for a week when we invited all the high school kids in to come play on this NBA floor.
You know what I mean? Right.
So like once we did that, you know, everything was full steam ahead.
Did you have climate control issues with the wood floor? I know sometimes depending on what your building looks like that can be an issue.
100%. It was definitely an issue that the flooring guy is excellent. Like they still do, you know, like Madison Square Gardens and a bunch of colleges and all in that area. Like they still do those floors and they do our floor. So it was like, he was like, I'm not putting this in unless you have climate control. So we got to put an HVAC unit in that was astronomical. It felt like, you know, we put that in.
Right.
So that was all taken care of. We sealed it all. They're sectioned so like they can move a little bit. So like, you know, in the wintertime, sometimes the gaps get a little bit bigger and we got to like tighten things up or whatever. But summertime, everything, you know, humidity swells a little bit and everything tightens up.
Gotcha.
We never really had any serious. The biggest issue was if you've ever seen those things put in, they're built for arenas. So you put in a corner and you slide it. Well, our building is like, there's walls all the way around the floor. So there was no way to slide those last pieces in. So we had to cut them and just like drop them in there. The flooring guy was like, how in the world did you get these in here? And he's like, walk alongside. He's like, oh, that's how you know, it was we put it together. Like, he's like, I can have my guys from Madison Square Garden come down. They'll charge you this amount of money and put the floor down. We were like, whoa, we got it.
We'll figure this out.
Yeah. So, you know, that's how I'm always like, I'll figure it out. That's how I think. And that was a long process. That's funny. We laid an entire, you know, each panel is 185 pounds. We're laying it down and then we're like, oh, it's off. We got to pull them all back up and then lay it back down again. But it was fun going through it all. So anyhow, once we got that all done, then it was just a matter of programming. And the whole time we were letting people know what we were doing. We were taking pictures. They were seeing the floor. So there was kind of like an excitement. And some people were familiar with the camps that we had run. And people were familiar with me because I played in the high school in the same town.
Right.
So there was just an excitement about this new thing. So we just started running clinics. And I mean, my first week, we just didn't charge anybody anything. We just did everything for free. And just so people would know what we're doing and if it was worth their money to spend it. And once we started, doing that, you know, what happened was we got some of the best players from a local league that were training with us. And I was like, I don't want to run the league. I just want to train you guys. 'Cause I've seen what the youth practices look like. You know, so I want to, like, I can really help you guys get better. At the time, I'm coaching JV boys. So I would take my JV boys practice plan and run it with fifth grade boys an hour later, you know, and we would just, so we were teaching press breaks. We were inbounds plays. It is a youth league that we're doing all this.
Right.
And so like, I was like, you guys just go play in your league with the YMCA and just train over here. And they're like, we want to do the league right here. And just like this. So we didn't even play games for the first 5 weeks. We were doing 3-on-3 and I said, well, we're going to do this the way I want to do this. And so like I taught them and I had to convince all the parents. I was like, listen, once we start playing, you'll see why we did it this way.
Right.
And then sure enough, once we started playing, kids are like passing, setting screens. They're like, there's obvious basketball happening. You know, they're reading screens. It was so much fun. And then, you know, that first year we had like 90 kids in the league and quickly ballooned to like 300, which is much more difficult to manage because the talent's kind of diluted a little bit. And now you really need people that can coach and teach skills and along the way. So mostly basketball. We also do other sports to kind of, you know, during the down times. And my favorite thing is I all summer long, I have morning workouts before our summer camps. So from like 7 to 9 every morning, we live at the beach resort. So we have, at once COVID hit and the EYBL was shut down, we had some kids that played in that were coming down for training. So, you know, we have a kid that is now at Virginia Tech. His sister plays at Penn State. And Luca Garza was in the gym for a week, and that was a lot of fun. So we had like some really high level guys that we were able to work with, and that was a great experience for me. And then, you know, some of the local kids got to play against them, you know, so they got to see how they work.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about my kid trying to get like a, you know, like the desire to play once he was in the gym at 6 a.m. with Luca Garza, and Luca's coming back at, he's got a beach workout at 12 and he's coming back at 8 o'clock at night. And he was just tagging along with me. He was like, "Dad, I want to go to the gym. I want to go to the gym. I want to go to the gym." So Luca had a big part of,
that's cool,
of my son, you know, having a real desire to get better and work.
Is a lot of it now word of mouth in terms of getting people in the door?
Almost all of it. I have a strong distaste for like spending money on marketing, because I feel like I'm flushing it down the toilet. You know, it's always been.
Plus, you got to know what you're doing, which is never know.
Right. Unless you're tracking it, you know, with different promo codes and stuff, it's just really hard to figure out. So yeah, it's always been word of mouth. You know, I got to the point where I had to leave the school and leave coaching because it got so big so fast to manage it. Right. So I did that for a couple years, and this was not all easy, man. There was times where I was like, I felt like Jason, you know, I had all these, I was doing 100 things with all these kids just doing way too much. And, ended up even having, I was in the hospital. I thought I was having a heart attack. Like, it was just so stressed out of my mind because I was bottlenecking everything.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, good. That's good. You're managing things a lot better than I am. I was not.
It's not the truth. It's not the truth. I'm sorry.
All right. So it was just like, I had to learn how to delegate, which is a great teaching point for my coaching staff now. Like, I wasn't a full-time head coach at the time. So once I got the full-time head coaching job, I knew how to like give responsibilities to people so I don't kill myself and slow things down. That's the biggest problem, is like, I had to make every decision. So nothing could get done until I touched that decision and made a decision. So, you know, just by, you know, my brother, my oldest brother came up, he's a business consultant. He was like, "You need to do this. This is," he sat with me for a week and just taught me how about business, because I didn't know anything about business. I knew stuff about sports, but I didn't know how to, like, I didn't know the accounting side of it. I didn't know management. I didn't know any of that. So he gave me kind of a crash course and helped myself and my wife, and really helped my sanity, you know. And he was very much on my side, like, this, you need to do what's best for you first and your family, and then figure out how this fits in. So once we did that, you know, I got to the point where I understood management. I didn't do everything. You know, at one point I was working 7:15, you know, maybe a 6 a.m. workout, going to school at 7:15, coaching JV basketball, and then sticking around for basketball, and then open gym until 10 o'clock at night. And I was like doing this for a year. And that's when I had like a, you know, I think it was my wife and I had our first argument in like 10 years. We never had an argument, and it just destroyed everything. I was just like, I need help with this.
Yeah, it's kind of tough when you're never home.
Yeah, for sure. So, and really the reality of it is I was going, I was in the gym, I was doing all this stuff. So I didn't really think too much about it.
Right.
Whereas, as you guys know, she's at home with the kids, and that's for a whole different ballgame, you know?
Yep.
So she was handling all that. So I felt the stress of that, but we got to the point, you know, now where we have a general manager who runs it. So I was able to get back into school, because what I missed was I had all the training and the skill work, and I could see guys get better, but then I had to go watch them play. I missed the team. I missed the competition.
Yep.
You don't get that in the summertime. You know what I mean? So like, I really missed that. So I wanted to get back into coaching. That's when I got back in, and started, you know, coaching the girls team.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website
that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I mean, you can get your fix. There's no question when you start talking about the training side of it, the camps and clinic side of it, which is that's primarily where I'm doing most of my basketball stuff now. And up until this past season, I've coached my kids at AAU and some travel stuff. But yeah, I think the one thing that when I think about missing coaching at the high school level, that you just, there's no replacing that competition piece of it, training with kids. And yeah, you're seeing them improve and there's definitely satisfaction in that and seeing kids get better. And the camp piece of it is always fun. And I enjoy that, but you definitely can't replace the competitiveness of going out there and competing in a high school varsity game and being able to just match wits with the other coaches and just the amount of time that you put into it. And then you get to measure yourself, right? You get to measure against somebody else, which you just don't get to do when you're talking about training. And you can get a tremendous amount of satisfaction out of helping those kids get better, but it's still not the same as going out and competing, you know, in front of the fans and in a real game.
You don't go through the adversity like that. So like, there's a lot gained when a team is going through adversity and the different personalities of the coaching staff and the players and the parents, is like everybody's going through it and trying to work it out and figure it out and come up with a solution. And you just don't deal with that in the off season. And rightly so. You can't, I don't think you can be in the pressure cooker like that all the time.
Right.
But you know, I just missed that. So I wanted to get back into coaching. Now here, I want to stay in coaching. I don't know that, you know, we're looking into now where we are with the business is, people have reached out to us about another facility about 30 minutes south of where we are now. So we're in the process of going through, you know, feasibility of that,
right.
Which is looking good. At that point, I'd probably have to get back in full time with the business. But one of the discussions I had with one of our partners was that, like, well, actually, he brought it up. I felt it, but he brought it up, was like, you need to stay coaching because that's who you are. You know what I mean? That's kind of like, and it's like with the team, but it's also like it, you know, if you're doing camps and you're doing training and you're doing clinics and stuff, you know what it is coaching. Those can be different things with like a, if you're a trainer that's never been a coach, you're missing a huge part of it. Like there's some things what I see people do and I'm like, no coach would allow that in a game.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
That's just never, if
those
you do 70, that,
those 79 dribble moves.
That's right. Like see, if you try to pull that off, there's no way that's getting up in a game. So like I was able to change how I train people because I was like, I need you to do these things that your coach is going to do. So like when we have my friend who's at Virginia Tech, he wasn't Memphis last year. And he's like, he needs to come off of Zooms and you know, 1-2 year old pull up and hit this. So like we design the workout based on shots that he's going to get for his team, not just based on what, you know what I mean? Like there's certain things that like are just a waste of time. Like,
for sure.
So we got to rep the shots that you're going to get and the skills that you got to have for your team. So like if you, that's one of the values of being a coach and, you know, working on training and clinics and stuff. Also with the youth league, I know what these kids need to be able to do to make Jason's team, to make a middle school team, to make, you know, and then to make the JV team and to make the varsity team. There's certain things that you need to be able to do. And sometimes I'm like, and that's not it. You know, one of the biggest things is learn how to work, learn how to be unselfish, learn how to move the ball, learn how to play defense. Like, so it just gives you a perspective that I think is invaluable for the business side of things that we can constantly. So like my general manager now is also coaching a high school team. And so like we have lots of our coaches, we've actually lost a lot of our youth coaches because now they got high school coaching jobs or middle school coaching jobs,
which is good,
which is right. That's what the part we want the players to be able to make those teams and we want the coaches to be able to become coaches. Now we just need more, coaches all the time.
Well, I think anybody who owns any kind of a business will attest to the fact that finding staff.
Yeah.
And good staff that's going to do and do the things that you want and do them in such a way that fits with what you're trying to accomplish. That's always, I think, the biggest challenge. And then when you find somebody who's good at their job and who does exactly what you want them to do and more. Those people, you got to hold on to them tight because
they don't last long.
Right.
They're on to something bigger.
Yep. There's not a whole lot of them out there. And you got to continuously work to make sure that you're putting the right product in front of people. There's no question about that. And it's interesting. I love what you said about the training piece of it in terms of making sure that people that you're working with, that the players you're working with are actually working on things that they're going to do in games. And I think that's one of the things that, as we've talked to coaches at all different levels, particularly the higher up you go, there's so much more of a focus on like, what do you do, right? As a third or fourth grader, we're trying to work on everything, right? You're trying to develop all your skills. Mm-hmm. And then the further up you go, the reality is there just aren't many players who get to do everything on the floor. And there's many more role players that, whether you're talking about high school varsity basketball, you're talking about college basketball, or certainly you're talking about professional basketball, like most players end up finding their niche because they're good at one or two things. And they're not the person that just gets to get the ball in their hands and do whatever they want. And so it's just interesting when you think about training at the different levels that with younger kids, we spend a lot of time developing their all around game. We want them to have all the skills. And then the older they get, the more you can kind of dial in of like, hey, here's the kind of shots you're going to get. You don't need the 17 dribble moves from half court, because the honest truth is you're never, ever, never going to get to do that. And so being able to understand that as a trainer, and I think coming at it, as you said, from a coach's perspective is so important. And I'm sure you see that with the players that you work with.
For sure. So we always we teach actions like all summer long with that morning crew, as I'm just teaching them actions. And I'm like, I don't know what your team's going to run. Sometimes you know, the coaching situation is always flip-flopping. We have a girl that's playing at Harvard, and I was like, well, you just had a new coach come in. And a girl from Arizona State just had a new coach come in. I'm like, what are you guys running? You're like, we don't know yet. Like, so I can't even. So I'm like, all right, well, you got to have, these are the actions that happen in any offense.
Right.
You know, you got to be able to handle a pick and roll. You got to be able to handle, you know, a dribble handoff. And probably a flare screen and coming off of pin downs and things like that. And so like, there's certain things that is where you do it and when you do it will be different from team to team, but like, you got to know how to make these reads and these decisions. So like in the morning time, we spend a lot of time just in decision-making, like making the reads when the defender goes under, or like, okay, recognizing where the tag is coming from. Is it coming from the strong side? And then, you know, a lift, you know, out of the corner, you know, that's a read. And so like, we just drill this over and over, and it's, I love it. It's so much fun. We got college guys playing with high school guys, high school girls, college girls, and they're all playing together, and they just don't, you know, it's like the way we do is whoever has the most personnel on the court, that's the ball we use. We got more girls, we're playing with
nice.
The ball. We got more guys, we're playing with the guys ball.
I like that.
And so I can't, as a player, that would have drove me crazy. But we've been doing it so long. Like,
that's cool.
One of our players that I've been working with since he was, man, I think the first time I met him, he was in preschool, and he just won the national championship in Division 3, Randolph-Macon. And so like, he'd be in there and he's like, no, coach, I get it. It's fine. We're just working on decision making anyhow. But like, so he's working with like high school girls and things, but I would match up with him.
Right.
So he's got to handle me on the ball or another college player.
Yep. Yep.
But at the same time, we're training. I don't need him to score on that play, that girl. He needs to be able to see the read. And, you know, as many teams are becoming more conceptual offensively, like, it just lends itself well to, they know how to do these actions. So then, you know, okay, you're running a Princeton offense, you're running these split cuts and, you know, high post flash or however, whatever it might be, they know how to do the action. Now they just know how to wear and when to do it.
Yep.
And they recognize the language. So I'll like share with them the language. So it's very much like, I'm trying to educate them. This is how coaches think. And the sooner you can start thinking like that, you're going to grasp offenses much easier than anyone else.
Yeah, no question. That makes a ton of sense. That's fun, man. It's fun to be able to have a variety. I'm sure for you as a trainer to be able to work with kids at different levels and the different genders and all that type of thing just makes it a lot more interesting when you get an opportunity to work with players at varying levels. And clearly you're working with some players that are at a high level, and that's always fun too, because then you get to feel like you get to use your expertise. Whenever I got a chance to work with higher level players, it was always fun. And in addition to a lot of the work that I did with younger elementary school players, where you're teaching them the basics, but then it's fun to be able to go into and teach some of the things that, you know, maybe your expertise lends itself better to when you're working with those higher level players. It's fun. It's cool that you have this whole variety of different things that you're doing, both on the business side and getting to do the training, and then you get to come back and work with your team and see it from both perspectives. And I'm sure that helps you to be able to be better at both of those jobs. So we're coming up here close to an hour and a half, Pat. I want to ask one final wrap up question, two-parter. First part, when you think about what you get to do day in and day out, what brings you the most joy? And then as you look ahead, and you can answer one or both of your main your main professions here, just what do you see as the biggest challenges ahead in the next year or two? Obviously, you have the potential of maybe opening up another building and continue to win and be successful with the high school team. So just talk about your biggest challenges and your biggest joys.
I think the biggest joy, it would have to be just seeing the development in players. I went through the same process with our on the business side with our staff, as well as our coaching staff on the school side. And it was identifying, you know, basically who are we, you know, what are our main advantages? How are we going to be successful? So we went through the same process, had our staff read a book called The Advantage, and went through it. And when we came down to core values, they were like the same, you know, they were some of the same exact things, part of because I'm involved in it, you know,
right.
And that's it. But one of the things has always been improvement, both on the business side and on the player side, is that my focus has always been on improvement. I've found that I surround myself with people who want to get better, whatever area of life that is. I gravitate towards those people that are lifelong learners that are always trying to figure out ways to just improve. Some of those people are 75 years old, but they want to get better at whatever right. it is they're doing.
Yep.
I just want to hang out with those people, you Absolutely. Know? And so like, that's one of the things I love about the business is that we only get people that come in there are trying to get better at whatever they're doing. Otherwise they don't show up.
Right.
You know, in school, sometimes they got to be there, you know, but on the business side, the biggest joy is seeing people improve, whether it be their skill or their person or their community. We're focused on improving those three things. So just seeing some, as you know, working with people, you don't always see the fruit of your labor. In fact, I think it's pretty rare. So when you do see it, it brings me a lot of joy. It reminds me of why I'm, you know, exhausting myself to try to help out.
Sure.
Whatever that growth might be, it's great hearing from kids that have graduated and seeing the success that they're having at the next level, or just growing as individuals. I think that's probably the biggest joy. And then the biggest challenge I see coming up is it's always the same, man. It's trying to balance a passion that I have for a sport with time spent with my family and my wife and my kids, and making sure that the people that I'm responsible to, my family, my players, my staff, and that everybody is getting what they need from me, and I'm not shortchanging anyone with family, my wife, and then my kids being, you know, first priority. That's really, it sounds shocking for me to say this, but that can get out of place really quickly. And it's never intentional. It's just like, it feels urgent at times. You know, we're coming up, you guys have already started, but we're coming up, we're starting our season week and a half. I'm taking off next week, you know, from workouts and open gyms right. and stuff, just to yeah. make sure that, you know, I dial in some time. My wife and I are going to go spend some time together. And it's just like, I'm not I don't think someone who is always purposeful about making sure that I spend this kind of time with this person, that person. I'm kind of just like, I just roll with it and go non-stop and then fall asleep. You know, it's kind of like how I feel like I'm in a tornado half the time, yeah, but it's like, that's how I function. So like making sure that I have designated time with each of my sons and making sure that I'm attending their events, you know, they're going to be having sports in the wintertime that I'm going to miss some of them. And that's going to be like, I don't ever remember my dad missing my stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like he was there for everything. So it's like a burden of mine, and they understand it obviously, but like, I just want to, the biggest challenge is always trying to balance making sure I'm providing, you know, for the family, and then also not shortchanging my responsibilities that I have at the various things that I'm doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a huge challenge, I think, for a lot of coaches, especially when you start talking about the amount of time it takes. I've said it numerous times, the amount of time it takes, the baseline just to be even remotely competitive is so much higher. The bar is so much higher than it's ever been. And then you talk about if you want to excel, that the amount of time that you have to put in as a high school coach is unbelievable. And then you're doubling down with the business side of it. So I can completely understand just the breakneck pace that you're going at and how challenging it has to be to be able to balance that with a family and doing all the things that you need to do as a dad, as a husband, and everything that goes along with that. There's a lot there, Pat. There's definitely a lot there without question. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you, about what you're doing, whether you want to share social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then once you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, I guess probably Twitter is the thing I frequently check. I don't even know what my handle is. Hang on a second. pwoods330 is the handle. That's probably the best way to contact me. Our business is factorysportsde.com. That's mostly just information for the local programs we have going on, but just to like chat, which I could geek out and talk to you guys about hoops and stuff forever and the business side of it too. So, you know, maybe that's the best way to chat with people that I haven't met yet is contacting me through that.
Perfect. Pat, can I thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight? Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.